Hello, everybody. It's Jughead, and welcome to the show. I'm so excited to bring you yet another classic Chicago musician to the Jughead's Basement program, John Haggerty. I had the pleasure of talking to him 10 years ago almost with me and Vapid interviewed him for Throb Throb, and it was so great to catch up with him again and to see him smile, which is rare. Because often he just has a bit of a half smile. And my friend, the punk rock cop, Bill, said that, wow, he smiled during your interview. And you could see this smile if you joined the Patreon. What a transition that was. I didn't even know I was going to go to that until I just started talking. But yes, you could see John Haggerty's smile on video if you join my Patreon. Go to www.jugheadsbasementpodcast.com. And to the right, you'll see a little button that says Patreon. It'll whiz you to that new location where you can become a member and donate at the $2, $5, and $10 tiers. Each tier gets you a little bit more shit, from a little shit to a lot of shit. And that's the same for the amount of videos. You get unedited videos of all the interviews that I conduct, and you get them brought to you before the at-home audience gets just the audio into their ears version. You also get writings that I do. I'm working on a book. I'm hoping to get back into it again here in Japan, a book called We Screeched, where I talk about the bands that I've been in, and it will also have photos from all the years, almost 30 years in music, and you'll get advanced looks at all of those chapters as I write them. So please do that. If you can't, I understand, as always, but do something like share the podcast with friends or potato chips, or share potato chips and eat my podcast with a friend. However you like it, just have the podcast involved. Or you can write reviews at Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcast. Also, I have a sponsor on this particular episode, and that is Factor Meals. Since I am in Japan, I couldn't get them, but they were nice enough actually to send a meal to my sister in Morton Grove, and she very much enjoyed the food. She said the spices were delicious, but you'll hear more about that in the middle of the show. I think I'll just leave it there. Let's do it. Right now, you're listening to I Don't Know by Naked Raygun off their 1985 record, Throb Throb. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Jughead's Basement episode 179 of Lo-Fi Interviews with Hi-Fi Guests with John Haggerty. On this episode, John Haggerty of Pegboy and Naked Raygun talks to us about the musicians and producers he has worked with in his long career. We talk about such people as Santiago Durango and John's beginnings in Naked Raygun, Ian Burgess and recording in France with Pegboy, Steve Albini and The Scene, Pierre Kesdi and the influence of Strike Under on John's confidence as a guitarist, Eric Spicer and DV8, Jeff Pizzati and A Band is a Band, and a group of individuals is a group of individuals, befriending Jake Burns of Stiff Little Fingers, plus much, much medley Shanker, Page, and Blackmore, more.
Hey, John. You can hear me?
I definitely can hear you. That's good.
Okay. Can you see me?
I cannot.
Good. Oh, wait, how about this?
Ah, there you are. See, no, you got a good looking face there.
Yeah, sure.
Thank you, sir. Most people I see have like something on their walls in the background. You have just a blank white wall.
Yeah. Interior decor is not my thing.
Well, thank you for meeting with me, John. It's really it's an honor for me to do this again with you.
Oh, thank you.
I was actually looking at the last time. Me and Vapid did a exploration of Throb Throb, and it was exactly 10 years ago to the week.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't think it was that long ago.
No, it was, yeah. 2013.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah.
How's Danny doing anyway?
He's doing good. I mean, he's been doing really good with balancing like a full, what, three kids now, family, and still pushing out like a new album like every couple months.
Yeah, I noticed that, yeah. And you're living in Japan now?
I am, yeah.
Permanently, like?
Oh, no, I've been coming here off and on for about 9 years. I have a contract at Universal Studios, the theme park here.
Wow.
Yeah. In Japanese, too. They taught me Japanese. It's crazy. But I have a girlfriend here now of like 5 years, so that we yeah. I come here more often.
Good work if you can get it, huh?
It is actually good work. Yeah, and I get to be in a beautiful country. It's really, you know, I love it here.
Yeah, I've heard nothing but good things about Japan.
Yeah, it's great for like long hikes and walking. I'm in Osaka, but which is a big city, and it's actually a sister city to Chicago, so it has a lot of same kind of blue collar feel to it. A lot of really good food. But what the cool thing is, just right outside the city, not even going like 20 minutes, you're into like mountains. We're surrounded by mountains, so there's nice hiking and walking and stuff. So,
nice.
Yeah, it's good.
So you think you'll be there for a while, huh?
Yeah, I'm at least here for a year, and then I'm probably signing another contract. But I still have a house. I have a house in Jefferson Park, so I do have to go back sometime. The last 2 hours I've been taking notes. I mean, it's sprawling, but I thought a cool way would be based on like people we know and you've worked with. So
yeah,
if we want to do it from there, but I might have some questions here and there along the way that are unrelated to that. And I always try to do these more as a conversation. I mean, of course I have it structured for questions for you, but if you want to ask me something like you already have, then go right ahead. So, and I thought that the cool place to begin was, and for my audience who doesn't know, but you were in Peg Boy with your brother, Joe. So, and you've been working with him for a long time. So I won't ask you how you two met, because I assume, are you older or is he older? I can't remember that.
I'm older by quite a bit. 6 years, yeah.
Do you remember his birth?
Shortly after.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I don't actually remember, you know, like my mom being in the hospital giving birth, but, you know, I was six or whatever. So, yeah, that's pretty aware of it.
Yeah, my sister was 5 years younger than me, and I remember them coming in because we had the Christmas tree up. It was January 1st.
Yeah.
And I have that image of them coming through the door with the baby basket.
Yeah.
It was Pegboy the first band where you two worked in the same band together?
Yeah, although Joe did a few gigs with Naked Raygun when Eric was sick.
Mm.
Filled in maybe once or twice. But yeah, it was the first actual band that we were in together.
Does that seem strange now that you've been in a band with them so long? Or did you like discover music together? Or was it you just had different paths towards the same goal?
Yeah, I was into it maybe a little before. He's so much younger, you know, like 6 years is a pretty
long
time, especially when you're that young, you know, like in your teens or whatever. I was 16, he was only 10.
Yeah.
You know? So I think he started listening to some of the stuff I was listening to and eventually got into it, I think. But he was pretty young by the time. He got good pretty fast.
You know, some of the reviews that I was seeing, I was looking back at old Pegboy reviews, and a lot of them talk about the chemistry or whatever the word is between, they can hear like between your brother and drums and you on the guitar, that there's some sort of chemistry there together. I'm really bad at like picking that stuff up. Sometimes just reviewers like to talk about that, but I mean, there might be something to it. There is some sort of tightness that's really nice there that Like, neither of you seem to be afraid to actually play your instruments.
Yeah, but I think that would have happened regardless of, genetics. Shared genetics. I think when people learn how to play with each other, the tightness comes, or it doesn't. I don't think it depends on that, being related necessarily.
Was when you got the idea, I mean, I'm going to probably review this in another way, but we're sticking with this idea of people in your life way of talking about your bands. But when Pegboy started, was that a goal then to work with Joe?
Yeah, it seemed like it was the most logical thing to do. I thought, I knew we could play, and I knew we got along, and that's pretty much all you need. So yeah, he was the logical choice, sir. I didn't even think about anybody else, I don't think.
So I'm going to get back to that when I get to other people, but I kind of want to hit the early Naked Ray Gun stuff because you were there from 83 to 89, but you came in first on the saxophone.
Yeah.
So were you like you and your brother both musically trained, or did you?
Well, grade school band, they call that musical training. Yeah. He was a percussionist, and I was a saxophone player in grade school, starting in fourth grade, and then continued through high school. You had to take an art in high school, some kind of art thing, and a band qualified. So to get my art credit, I played in the band, played saxophone.
By the time that you played on Basement Screams, right, as
Yeah.
saxophone, that was in 83. How did they get to you to play saxophone?
I don't actually recall how they found out that I could play saxophone. I don't remember. Yeah, I don't actually remember that particular thing. Just that they needed a sax player on a song, and somehow or another they found out that I could, at least fake it, and I had one.
You had one. That was probably the key to
That was really it. Yeah.
it. I'll also have you notice that that time period was almost 40 years ago. So
Yeah.
for not remembering it is probably okay.
Yeah, I hope so. 40 years. Yeah.
That was 80. I think that was October of 83. So it's almost 40 years or something like that. Let's get back into the Peoples. Who brought you into that project?
Well, I was brought in just for the saxophone on Basement Screams. They found out that I could play a little bit of guitar, so eventually they worked me into playing guitar with Santiago, having two guitar players, and that was a lot of fun. I thought that was a great thing, playing with Santiago. I thought him and I were a pretty good combination because we're not similar in very many ways, but seemed to play well together. That period was unfortunately really short, but really cool, I thought.
Yeah, I was lucky enough. I did a after Throb Throb. I did one on Big Black, and he hardly ever did interviews, and he did one with me. I was really glad they did that. He's such an interesting, unique person. Yeah.
Santiago Alonso Durango, born 1957, is a Colombian American attorney and musician. He is best known for his work with Naked Ray Gun and Big Black. Santiago appears on episode 15 of Jughead's Basement, Big Black from Bulldozer to Atomizer.
He is, yeah, he's a big part of the early punk community, big inspiration to a lot of people at that time, his contemporaries. And I think to this day, people who look hard enough at the origins of the punk rock scene in Chicago, it's hard to overlook Santiago's contribution.
Do you know which one of them, once again, is that like a loss to the memory of the past? Do you know which one brought you in, or were you friends with someone or what?
Well, everybody kind of knew everybody else.
Yeah.
All the bands in the early days kind of, you know, at least knew each other in passing. And as far as I can recall, it was Santiago who brought me in.
I don't know if I want to get into this, but there was like a big change after Throb Throb, where it developed into what people call like what is known as the best grouping of Naked Raygun, was like you, Spicer, Kesdi, and Pizzati. What? How did that start? I mean, it seemed like it was started by these other people, and then other people took over like the band. It's such an interesting dynamic of how that shifted.
Yeah, the band was actually started by Santiago and Jeff's brother, Marco, and this guy named Bobby Strange, the drummer, who to this day is an enigma to me. I've never met him. Yeah. I don't know what happened to him. Nobody seems to know what happened to him. But I think originally it was those three, and then they were together for a while, and they needed a singer, and then they called in Marco's brother, Jeff, to sing. Right, so it was originally started by those three, and then those three eventually were replaced. All three of them were gone by 83 or 84.
Yeah, Camilo was in there too, right? Camilo, yeah.
Camilo took over for Marco, Jeff's brother. Kaleo took over for Bobby Strange, the Enigma. Yeah, shuffling members pretty much ever since.
Here's the thing that, I mean, might even be hard to talk about, and I didn't even think about bringing this up, but listening back now to the Naked Rayguns and the things that appeal to me, your guitar does come in very strong and confident. I don't know, did you feel like you, from that album Throb right away, that you were that this was your band for a while, that like you made a sound there that wasn't quite there before? I mean, there wasn't much before you, but
yeah, well, before I joined the band, the band was a lot more experimental. They would do all kinds of weird, kind of cool stuff, off the wall stuff. Like one gig, they played in, each member played in four separate corners of the room. You know, one day they'd have a rockabilly tune, and the next gig, they'd have some kind of spacey, weird keyboard music. They were a lot more experimental and kind of weird, punky rock kind of stuff. And then when I joined, I kind of had a more narrow bandwidth of what I liked to sound like and what I thought was what I liked to do. So I think that a lot of people were disappointed that it wasn't as creative and experimental. It was just started to get a little more focused on, you know, kind of one sound, and for better or for worse. And, you know, depending on who you talk to, I think some like it, some don't.
Well, I think when I was looking back at this time period just earlier today, I was like, and you know, you could create your own scenarios of how things divide or part. But I was thinking of all the, because you worked later on, or your work contributed to the Joy Thieves, and that had Chris Connolly and all that sort of, there's like Big Black, and then there's Naked Raygun that parts, and then you have Ministry over here, and then you have like Effigies and Naked Raygun, which are more punk. But they're all working together, it seems like, in a network of like friends.
Yeah, that's an interesting project there, I think. So much in the beginning, it seemed like the Effigies, Naked Raygun, Da, Strike Under, basically all the bands that are on that Busted at Oz compilation were, you know, kind of closer knit than say the other ones, but still it was, we all had a lot in common.
Busted at Oz was a 1981 compilation put out by the short-lived record label Autumn Records in Chicago. The compilation featured Naked Raygun, Strike Under, Subverts, Effigies, DA, and Silver Abuse.
I think this is a good moment now where I can bring in another person on my list to you. And I do want to make this link eventually to back to Pegboy, but let's see where it goes here. So from the beginning there, you're working with Ian Burgess. Who
Yeah.
Also, from what I remember from Throb Throb, kind of had a a good part in the creating of your guitar sound too.
Yeah, absolutely.
So absolutely. Can you talk a little bit about the beginning relationship with Ian Burgess and what that meant to you?
Ian Burgess, November 24th, 1953 to February 11th, 2010, was an English record producer and audio engineer. He helped define the sound of the Chicago post-punk music scene in the 1980s. Burgess worked with a number of key underground bands, including Big Black, Naked Raygun, The Effigies, Rifle Sport, Toothpaste, Get Smart, Ministry, Green, Bloodsport, Pegboy, Poster Children, and Bhopal Stiffs.
Yeah, I met Ian probably like 1982 or even 81. He was doing sound for some band that I can't remember at the Cubby Bear.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked what he was doing, you know, with them. And so I went up and I struck up a conversation with them. We hit it off right away. He had the, we saw eye to eye as far as what were the problems with, you know, live sound and recorded sound. In those days, both live engineers and recording engineers did not know how to handle loud guitars.
Yeah.
Blew their mind and fucked up their program. They didn't want to deal with it and know how to deal. Ian was the first one who appreciated that you can't really get a specific tone without a specific volume. You know, you can't just tell the guitar player or the bass player or whoever it is to just play softer and expect to get the same tone.
Yeah.
You can't, it doesn't work that way. Now, I appreciate that it fucks up their job, makes their job a lot harder. But it, you know, he was the first one to appreciate that, yeah, the guitar has to be this loud if you want it to sound the way you want it to sound. And you have to be able to work around that.
Was he already working as a recording engineer at that point?
I believe so. He was definitely working as a live sound man. Yeah, I would say that he was probably at CRC at that time, Chicago Recording Company, during the day, and they allowed him to bring in bands at night because CRC was just basically a commercial studio for making, you know, Burger King ads during the day, and so it was unoccupied at night, and they allowed him to bring in bands and work with the state of the art equipment. So that was a pretty cool.
Yeah, there's something about, I mean, even your period is a little bit before mine. You know, you come in 83, I come in around 88. But even at that time, and I've talked to a lot of people on this podcast about how most punk bands recorded at those type of nice studios. Like we did Solid Sound in Hoffman Estates, but it was always the after hours. Like Phil Bonnet at Hoffman Estates would work the regular corporate stuff, and then he would stay all night and record us, you know, for nothing.
Yeah.
So it was really interesting that there weren't really any punk studios back then. It was all us trying to like hop into these established corporate, you know, sound machines.
I remember at CRC, they had like a $80,000 reverb machine or something.
Yeah.
It looked like the Starship Enterprise, you know, shit, just crazy.
Yeah, I think one of the sound that Ian, you know, it's funny because I think when I first started getting into the Chicago scene, I didn't like his approach to sound, but I learned to like it quite a bit. It's in some ways it felt like I was listening to music in a cave because I don't know if that's the reverb or how he placed instruments or not, but it was something I didn't like. And then I started really liking eventually.
Yeah, well, Ian used to screw around a lot with mic placement, experiment with mic placement and stuff. Yeah, I remember one time he decided to set up three mics for the guitar, one in a tiled bathroom, have the amp in a tiled bathroom with a close mic, and then in the hallway next to the bathroom have a mic, and then at the foot of the stairs have a mic, and then like take those three inputs and mix those together. And that sounded pretty cool because, yeah, different levels of reverb, different types of reverb, you know, naturally from the room, not from a machine. Some cool stuff like that he would do. And
I was just looking back at when I first heard Throb Throb, and I think, is it Throb Throb that has, Rat Patrol is the first one on there, right? Yeah, and that just that the guitar is so strong. It's kind of funny because I was thinking of the songs right before I did this interview with you, John, about which ones influenced me as a guitarist or trying to. And I looked at the two and it was I Don't Know and Rat Patrol. And those are actually ones that you're credited for co-writing, I think, with Jeff. I think there's other ones on there, but those were the two. I was like, oh, now that makes sense. Those are the two that I like the most. And those were by the ones that you had done.
Yeah, that's the one that Ian did that fancy miking.
What I was impressed with, like I said earlier, is that I still don't think what I learned from you, and then I also took a lot of my metal influences, like Judas Priest and you know, stuff like that, that had those really strong melodic solos. You went to them like in, I don't know, with a confidence that just sounded strong, like your picking was solid. I don't know. Is that something people tell you, or do you something you nurtured over time? I don't know if you even know what that means, because you're such a, I don't know. It has such a blue collar sound to it. Like, it's like almost like metal, like you're like you work at a metal work.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess so. I think that I owe that to my earlier influences. You know, I was really into hard rock when I first started playing, because when I first started playing, there was no punk rock.
Right, right.
So my big bands were Deep Purple, Black Sabbath, and Led Zeppelin. You know, if what you're hearing is, you know, however you want to describe it, as confident picking or just lowering the boom with a power chord, I just got that from Tony Iommi and Ritchie Blackmore and Jimmy Page.
Yeah, I actually just looked back at your influences on the wiki page, and I was like, oh, two of those are exactly mine. Ritchie Blackmore, and you had Michael Schenker in there too.
Yeah, I like Michael Schenker too. Oh, yeah.
I wish I could play like them. But the cool thing about Ritchie Blackmore, and I think when I interviewed, I just forgot his name, from Zero Boys. I just forgot his name.
Paul Mahern is the frontman of Zero Boys, and he is also a music producer, and his episode is 114.
But he talks about how Ritchie Blackmore used to be a studio musician, like way back before he even formed Deep Purple. And you can still hear that solid, like he didn't hammer or peel, it was what he's known for, like he would pick every single sound. And that's the thing that I heard in Rainbow, I think I was discovered before I went back and learned more about Deep Purple. Such a distinctive, clear sound that he plays. Yeah.
Yeah. The same thing happened for me. I got into Rainbow and then went back and listened to Deep Purple.
John in the future here. I seem to be interrupting a lot now, but that is just because I'm excited about talking about metal music with John Haggerty. It'll lessen as we go. I just wanted to clarify that after going back and listening to Ritchie Blackmore, he of course uses hammer-ons and peel-offs, which is a metal guitar term that's all strands of guitar playing use. But what is specific about Ritchie Blackmore's is he picks so clearly that becomes more apparent than how a lot of musicians use the hammer-on and peel-offs. You can hear the pick hitting the strings.
But yeah, as far as the picking goes, yeah, that's I think I was heavily influenced by guitar players that picked every note, and you know, not just wave the pick lightly over.
Yeah,
and Blackmore certainly is one of them. Iommi is another one of them. I mean, you hear some of his leads, you can hear his right thumb like clacking against, you know, scraping against the string.
Thank you.
Johnny Winter was a big early influence on me because he influenced my guitar teacher, was a big Johnny Winter fan. So he would tell me, do this riff, you know, do it 400,000 times so you can do it as fast as Johnny Winter. As clear and as loud and as, you know, confident. I think that's probably a pretty good word for it, you know.
Yeah. I had those influences too, but I didn't have that confidence. It took me a long time until I, even at past Weasel, Screeching Weasel, I started more of an acoustic punk band after that. And that's when I had to get more confident in order to make sound out of acoustic that was energetic. I had to like learn how to pick more confidence. But I don't even, my, I was a little bit too young, but my brothers used to always, and I used to be so jealous. They used to see the Scorpions and, Michael Schenker was in the Scorpions and that at this place called Beginnings, which was in like the north suburbs.
Yeah. I remember that place.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I actually saw Ultravox there.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Ultravox came to Beginnings like in probably 1980 or something in that weird venue in the suburbs. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. My brother used to be a like a amateur photographer, and he used to on his walls. He, but I have all those pictures. Like he liked a lot of like a band called Max Webster was another one of his big bands. I don't know if you heard of them.
Yeah.
He knew the Tubes when nobody knew who the Tubes were. You know, but yeah, they mostly went to Beginnings, and then there was also the Thirsty Whale. I think was the other one that they.
Yeah, weird times.
Yeah. I think a good transition might be, and I don't know where to take it because there's, I mean, he has such a, oh no, no. You know what I want to say? I want to stick on Ian Burgess and skip to a Peg Boy record that I didn't know until I interviewed Larry, I think last year, and I went back and reviewed the Peg Boy records and Earwig. I think it's one of those I learned to love way later than when you recorded it. Like, I listen to that record and I feel like there's some really interesting experimentation that almost goes back to like Throb Throb to me. Like it seemed like you just let a little bit more go on that one. And why I'm bringing it up now is because that was your last, I think, recording with Ian Burgess. You flew out to France, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Ian bought an old farmhouse in France and still there. His partner, Peter Dymel is taking it over. It was in Normandy, really beautiful country, and it was just a lot of fun. And I think of all the records that we've made, we probably went into this one least prepared. So there was a lot of kind of more improvising on this one, and you know, for better or for worse.
But I did, once again, I like it a lot because I like a little bit of that. I like the really straightforward Peg Boy stuff, but there was something really nice about even the song, what I wrote, Over the Hills, which is a nice acoustic. Like it just seemed like maybe you were in France and you were on this place and you just had the time to just like.
Yeah, that, and we were running out of ideas and didn't have that made to begin with.
Well, that's kind of funny because most people, when they run out of ideas, they end up going to the bar chord, and you end up going to these more, to me, like more complicated or layered things.
Yeah, we're just pulling whatever we could out of our ass. that's a play on the Led Zeppelin song because that one starts off with Over the Hills Far Away.
Yeah.
Call it Over the Hills and Into Segre. The nearest French town to his studio.
And was his setup pretty much this? I mean, you've worked with him quite a bit, so was his setup pretty much the same there? Did it feel different, if I remember?
Yeah, it was pretty different. I think it was an old French farmhouse, you know, built in like the 1800s sometime, and you know, the beams were just like huge chunks of wood, and yeah, it had a different feel. Definitely. A good feel, yeah.
Yeah, to me, it's interesting how whether you purposely or accidentally, or just because you said you didn't have enough material, there's something about environments that will affect the sound, like whether you realize it or not. Because it does, that one, amongst the other ones, sounds very different than the other Peg Boy records.
Yeah. It was a lot of fun, very different. And yeah, we were kind of pressed to come up with stuff on the spur of the moment. And, you know, I don't know if that ever works out, but if you like it, I'm really glad.
I do. And Larry actually said that he learned to appreciate it more over time too, like when he went back and listened to it. but I want to get to Larry soon, but I think a good next step would be on my list that I sent you, who was one of Ian's proteges, which was Steve Albini, who you've worked with quite a bit too, like danced around the scene. He's another one that sort of goes in all different directions. When did you remember crossing paths with him? Did you see him in a show? Or were you just like friends?
Yeah. I remember meeting Steve. He came here to go to college at Northwestern, studied journalism.
Yeah.
And I think that was, that would have been like 1980 or 81, maybe.
Yeah.
And I met him pretty much in 80 or 81. He was coming to shows and stuff. And, you know, he immediately, you know, made himself part of the scene. We used to call it the scene. It's more like a community, I guess, of musicians. You know, he was a welcome addition, very helpful to the community. You know, he was able to record bands, you know, very cheaply, do a good job.
I can't recall from there. Have you actually recorded with Steve?
Peg Boy has. Yeah.
There's a Peg Boy.
Everything that we didn't do with Ian, we did with Steve.
According to my records, Steve Albini recorded the EP for FORE and also played bass in 1993. And then he engineered and produced Cha-Cha D'Amour, a full-length record, in October of 1997.
Let's hit a little bit more with Naked Raygun before we go to Larry. And so after that first record, Throb Throb, or the first, I call it the first, but you actually had Basement Screams, which was more of an EP album. The next one is, right, All Rise, which is when Eric and Pierre come in. Do you remember them coming into the band then?
Oh, yeah. That's yeah. Once you get to that stage, I start remembering a lot more. Yeah. I remember Pierre and Eric coming into the band. It was, I wanted Pierre in the band because I've been a fan of him since the Strike Under days. I was and am a big Strike Under fan. You know, personally, it was seeing them at O'Banion's in front of like, you know, 10 people or something. And I watched them play, and it was the Bjorklund brothers, Chris and Steve, and Pierre on bass, and Bob Furum on drums. And, you know, I fell in love with that band. And, you know, what they did for me is, I watched them and I thought, man, this is really good. But at the same time, I said, you know, I could probably do this. For the first time, I realized, because, you know, up until then, like I said, the people that I liked and looked up to, and Ritchie Blackmore and Iommi and Paige, guys like that. And I'm like, I'm never going to be that good. And I had it in my head that, well, you got to be like that good to write songs and make records and play music. And once I saw those guys, that idea just went completely out of my head. What do you need? You don't need to be a virtuoso to have a band. So I owe that to Strike Up, saying, yeah, you know, this is great, and I think I might be able to do this.
Johnny's got a problem and he's out of control.
Welcome to the middle of the show, where I get to talk to you about this week's sponsor. I have told you about ingredients brought to your door to make your meals at home, but sometimes, I know, whether it's going to work and then you're going to go to some punk concert that night, or you do two jobs like a lot of people, or you just don't have time and you just want to sit in front of the TV and veg out, you might want someone to cook this meal for you. And now that we're in the thick of summer, you might be looking for wholesome, convenient meals to support sunny, active days. Well, Factor, America's number one ready-to-eat meal kit, can help you fuel up fast with flavorful and nutritious ready-to-eat meals delivered straight to your door. You'll save the time, eat well, and stay on track reaching your goals. If you're worried about whether this is nutritious or not, or if you're on a diet, well, also you can stick to your wellness goals with premium, ready-to-eat meals featuring high-quality ingredients such as broccolini, leeks, and asparagus. Treat yourself to 34-plus weekly restaurant-quality options like bruschetta shrimp risotto. Ooh, that sounds great. If you've ever seen the movie Big Night, you can learn a lot about risotto and that it's not just rice. You can also get Green Goddess Chicken, which sounds divine, and Grilled Steakhouse Filet Mignon, which can also be read incorrectly as Filet Mignon. These meals are ready in just 2 minutes. Round out your meal and replenish your snack supply with an assortment of 45 plus add-ons, including breakfast items like delicious apple cinnamon pancakes, bacon and cheddar egg bites, and potato, I love potato, potato, bacon, and egg breakfast skillet. Or, for an easy wellness boost, try refreshing beverage options like cold-pressed juices, shakes, and smoothies. I can always go for a good shake. But there are also larger meal options like keto to calorie smart, vegan and veggie, and protein plus. Prepared by chefs and approved by dietitians, each meal has all of the ingredients you need to feel satisfied all day while meeting your goals, while hammering down on your guitar or your drums, or standing in that pit craving the energy to whip yourself around that dangerous circle. So do me a favor and head to Factor Meals, F-A-C-T-O-R, Meals, M-E-A-L-S, .com/Jughead50 and use code Jughead50 to get 50% off. That's code Jughead50 at FactorMeals.com/Jughead50 to get 50% off.
Johnny's got a problem and he's out of control.
And did you like befriend Pierre before, or once you needed, he came in on bass, I would imagine, right? Yeah, he came in on. Did you just approach, did someone from Naked Dragon approach him, or did?
Yeah, I think it was me. That was correctly. Yeah. I always liked Pierre's bass playing. I liked his presence too. He just looked like a thug, you know?
Yeah.
And I thought the thing about him is, you know, everybody says, you know, most of us are lucky enough to come across a person who will give you the shirt off their back. Pierre actually was that guy. He would do anything for you if you were his friend. And he would literally give you the shirt off his back and not have a second thought about it. He was like that all of his life.
Yeah, I remember Larry saying that too. And quite a few people have said that about Pierre.
There isn't anything he wouldn't do for his friends.
Pierre Kesdy was born on January 4th, 1962, and died of cancer on October 9th, 2020.
He played in such Chicago bands as Naked Raygun, Peg Boy, Strike Under, Arsenal, and Trial by Fire. He was also the younger brother of Effigy's frontman, John Kesdy. So he came in, and Spicer is in there too. How did he get involved?
Let's see. Cleo left the band. We needed a drummer. We had a couple in mind. I think it was between Eric Spicer and Anthony Ilardi. And Anthony was a great drummer and a great kid, but he wasn't old enough. Mm-hmm. He was definitely way under 21. I thought, you know, although he was plenty good enough to be in the band, I foresaw some problems, you know, with if we're playing in bars, which we mostly did, or they wouldn't even let him in.
So, yeah, once again, I most of my audience probably knows this, but at that time, an all-age venues was very, not many of them at all. So you really had to take that into consideration when you were forming your band.
Yeah, technically, it's illegal to have an underage member in a bar. You know, so I don't think we could have put together shows, you know, especially out of town where we didn't know anybody. And, you know, if we walk in with a 18-year-old drummer, you know, they might just say, "Hey, gig's over."
Do you know where Eric Spicer came from? I mean, was he in part of the scene? I don't even know if he was in bands before that or not. Or...
Yeah, he was in. I can't remember. And they were pretty good too. And I just, you know, that's embarrassing. But he was.
That's all right, because I have this thing called Future John where when I'm editing, I'll come in and I'll put in.
Yeah, please do.
Eric Spicer's.
Whatever you want in there. I don't want to spend time trying to recollect it, but
no. Yeah, I mean, actually, if you want to take a moment, let's see if it shows up in the DV8.
That's it.
There it is. Yeah, I'll have to look that one up. I think I've heard it before. Learn to Say Goodbye, Guns on the Right. They were on Tough Records, 1981. Yeah.
It's all coming back to me now.
How many times am I going to see you cry?
This is one of those intangible things, or like, you know, it's an artist feely thing, but did it feel different with those guys? It sounds like I love Throb Throb, by the way. I mean, that's like, I love the artsy part of that and it's so interesting, but there is something very solid about like the next three records that you guys are on, All Rise, Jettison and Understand. It seemed like those were like the pieces that fit into that. Very solid, maybe a little bit more simple than it was before, but more like played better and more just, I don't know, solid is the word. Yeah. So did that feel that way when you recall?
Yeah, it did. I think most of that is explained by the songs on Throb Throb were written over a long period, a relatively long period of time by, you know, four or five different people.
Yeah.
The influences of Camilo, and Kaleo, Jeff, Santiago, all coming together on Throb Throb, which, you know, I think lends a lot more diversity to that record. And then by the time we move on from Throb Throb, it's pretty much just the four of us instead of six different people over like a 6-year period. It's four people over a 1-year period.
Yeah, putting out a year, you know, record a year, yeah. What I was also, I wouldn't say amazed by, but I was talking to someone in my pod. Oh, I was talking to the guy from Hot Water Music, Chris, because they covered one of the Naked Raygun songs for the Pierre Kesdy tribute.
Yeah.
And he talks about how that it's on the outside, you know, like everyone often gravitates towards the singer, like Jeff, who's out front and he has a strong voice. But when you start looking at the notes and all that, there's almost everyone has like a writing credit, and they're like there's a lot more diversity in the writing of songs than one might it might appear to look like, which I think is interesting. Like once you look at, oh, like Eric Spicer has lyrics and words, and then, you know, you of course have, you know, show up on most of them. And then Jeff has somebody's not on all of them, you know? So I think that's an interesting dynamic for a band that sounds so like one person led. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I never liked the idea of giving personal credit. The other guys in the band thought it was a good idea, but I never thought it was a good idea. I thought that's why in Peg Boy, there's no, you know, all songs written by Peg Boy, because that's the way it is. If you're in a band and it truly is a band, and as opposed to a group of individuals, then you write songs together. And even if on the very rare occasion where somebody would bring in a song completely written, which never happens, and dictate exactly what each member is going to play, which never happens, you know, then you may be able to put your name on it. But I don't think it's right to do it, even if you actually write every single thing and dictate every single part. I still don't think it's it's just not, you know, it's not a band is a band. You know, yeah. And a group of individuals is a group of individuals, and bands are much better. I mean, I don't think any group of individuals will never amount to anything more than the sum of the parts, whereas a band sometimes will.
Yeah, go beyond itself. Yeah. I agree with you. With Screeching Weasel, it was so obviously that Ben Malik was a writer and Vapid was a writer. But, you know, I wrote my parts on every song, but I didn't get credits for those. But once I started my next band, Even in Blackouts, which I did for 15 years, that was my rule, too, that it was just everyone wrote the songs. What I did start doing eventually, since I wrote most of the lyrics, was I had to start saying that I wrote those to people that would ask because they wanted to know what they were about or something. And then I was like,
Yeah,
I wrote that. But the songs are by the band.
Yeah, I mean, you might come in with the majority of the original idea or even the majority of the song, but still, it's not going to sound the same if you play it with three different individuals. You know, it's never going to sound the same.
Now, before I leave Naked Dragon, I do want to, I definitely want to talk about Jeff Pizzotti and you working together a lot. Such a strong voice, and you have a strong guitar, and it seemed like it was for quite a while, it was a great pairing of, once again, like I said, it's a full band, but those two elements together just alone were like a powerhouse.
Yeah, Jeff is a great front man, or was a great front man.
Yeah.
And he can really tell a good story, too. I recently reminded of that. I saw an interview with him from, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah.
He can tell a good story. He can still tell a good story. Although sometimes he doesn't let the truth get in the way of a good story, which is cool.
I've learned that.
But still, he's fun to listen.
Here's the thing I'll throw at you, and you don't have to respond to it if you want. But me and Ben, who started Screeching Weasel, we were in the band for 20 years, and we toyed, in my mind, because I love thinking about this stuff, like what is friendship? What's a bandmate? And I sometimes analyze that I don't even think we would be friends if we didn't have the band. Like that brought us together, but ultimately we would go our separate ways, even though the band was together like 20 hours a day. Sometimes we lived together. But at the end of the day, I would say he was like almost more my business partner and creative, working person than a friend. So I'm just interested in your relationship with Pizzotti. Were you like hangout friends during those time, or was it like a working relationship, or what would you characterize that as?
I would characterize it as a working relationship.
Yeah.
Unlike Peg Boy, which we're friends, like almost brothers. Yeah. We would come home from like 3-4 week tours, and the first thing we would do is we'd all go to the bar together and hang out more.
Yeah.
I, yeah.
That's the last step I want to make on this this interview with you, Jonathan.
As far as you know, Jeff and myself, we weren't you know, we wouldn't really hang out with each other unless it was you know, for the band.
Now, I think we touched on a little bit of the throb, just reaching to the future. And once again, I'm never into the digging into the drama of leaving, but basically there was some touring issues and some management issues with the band. But I'm more always more interested in the psychology of it. Like, was that a really hard decision for you to leave?
Yeah, it was. It was a very hard decision. You know, I'd given 6 or 7 years to the band, and I, you know, I loved what we were doing. I was, you know, very pleased with what we were doing, and yeah. But I think ultimately, the way that I looked at what a band should be, and what Jeff and how Jeff looked at what the band should be, were ultimately incompatible. You know, I think it's mostly, you know, I think Jeff thought of it as his band, and I like to think of it as our band. I don't think Jeff thought in those terms. I also think that that we had different ideas about how democratic band should be, and you know, democracy is a pain in the ass, admittedly. But it's very hard to make decisions when everybody has input. You know, much easier to just say, this is what's happening, and that's it. So, you know, dictatorships are, by nature, much easier to get things done.
To navigate, yes.
But, of course, what gets done is a lot of times not cool. So, and I think ultimately that's really what made me leave, is our ideas were so different fundamentally about what a band should be, that it just wasn't going to work any longer than it did. And I think it goes back to the, you know, is a band, or is a band just a group of individuals?
Yeah.
And, you know, I saw it one way and you saw it another.
Yeah. My last question on that is going to be, and this is, from my experience, and I'm going to lay some of that on you, when me and Ben broke up as friends and also business partners and music partners, I couldn't listen to the band for the longest time. But then I realized I was erasing out of my life stuff that I was a part of, that I did. And then I had made myself go back and re-like it again. And I still support the band beyond myself in the band. So I don't know if you've ever lost, or did you ever return to sort of an enjoyment in hearing it, or pride in what you did? Did you ever lose that for a while after that? Or,
you know, that didn't happen to me.
No.
No, I'm sorry to hear that it happened to you.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I those feelings didn't carry over into what we had accomplished.
Mm-hmm.
No. That must be kind of shitty.
Yeah, it was pretty shitty. But then once again, like when I realized, I was part of the heydays of the band, so I know I did my work. And once I allowed myself to think about that, I'm one of those people, I know some people like to complete their work and then they never listen to it again. I always listen to everything I've done. Like, I'll throw on one that I haven't listened to in a while.
Yeah.
And so it felt really nice to be able to go back to it and go, ah, okay, yeah, these are good songs.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you went back around. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. So so let's go into this more positive thing, which I think is great. I mean, it really does seem like a bunch of friends that, well, you did hang around in bars and then you have a band. I heard it from Larry, but I'd like to hear it from you about how he became part of that mixture of, because it was you and your brother. And who else did you have, Pierre, right there at the beginning? Or I can't.
No, Steve.
Yes, it was Steve. But did Steve come in with Larry, or did?
Steve came in with Larry from Bhopal Stiffs.
Yeah, yeah.
And Bhopal Stiffs made a record with Ian, so I knew them through that. And I always liked the Bhopal Stiffs. They were a great band. If you dig up anything on YouTube, They were really good.
Well, me and Weasel and them used to play all the time at Batteries Not Included, you know, in front of nobody.
Batteries Not Included.
But I used to say when Larry and Vince were in that band, they were like two big football wrestler players that like crushed their guitars. And they were so powerful. Like my face was just like that, you know, that guy, that commercial of the guy sitting in front of the speakers and you know, like everything.
Yeah.
That's how I felt with that band. Like it was just so powerful. They're one of my, to this day, one of my favorite Chicago bands was Bill Possum.
Yeah, they're all good. Schlittweiler on the drums.
Yeah, great. Yeah.
Steve Sailors is an excellent bass player.
Yeah. They were very impressive. And the way that he trumpeted everything equal, which was very interesting.
Yeah.
Bhopal Stiffs were a band from 1985 to 1989. You could find out the history of that band, where I have all of the members interviewed, on a Jughead's Basement episode number 17.
So did you have Larry in mind when you were going to start a band, or did that just...
Well, actually, it was Larry. Larry came up to me after I left Naked Ray Gun, and he said, you know, why don't you join Bhopal Stiffs? And I said, yeah... That sounds pretty good, but why don't we just start something new? And, you know, so we did.
And then you went in, recorded first was the three-chord Monte. It was the first one in 1990.
Yeah, we did that in Albini's basement, as I recall.
Yeah, I think so. I think he was in his basement at that time. Yeah, I think.
Yeah, he had a little bungalow in Avondale or somewhere like that, and...
Yeah, we did a couple of demo with Weasel did demos where actually Eric Spicer was our producer in the studio, and it was with Ian in Ian's basement.
That's right. Yeah, he drove up, he pulled up in a limo and a big fur coat. Helped you guys out.
I liked hearing you say it, and I want to hit it again because it was so nice, but I don't know how to ask a question about it. But there is something really beautiful almost about this friendship band, Peg Boy, you say. And it, I think it's part of what allows you to, even now when life gets harder, to find the time and the energy and to go out and play. You still do with this incarnation of the band. So you, in some ways, I feel like you did achieve that the band is a band sort of feel with them.
Yeah, I think so. It couldn't have turned out any better. I don't think you could be any closer or have more fun together.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of bands are better than us. A lot of bands are richer than us. But no band has more fun.
Larry is. Well, and there's another great, you know, frontman to watch too. Is Larry's pretty?
Larry, amazing. Yeah, Larry is the best frontman, I think.
Yeah, what I think is interesting about him too, and it's such an interesting dichotomy of this. Well, his father was a football player. We talked to him about that, and then he was a wrestler like me because I was a wrestler too in high school.
He was pretty good, I guess.
Yeah. But he has, and his writing is so personal. It's kind. I wouldn't say it's a contradiction because I know people are complicated, but at first glance, you wouldn't think he would get that deep about himself.
No, Larry is a great songwriter.
Yeah,
he is a great songwriter. I mean, as good of a front man as I think he is, and I think, you know, maybe other people think he is an outstanding songwriter.
Yeah. Is that anything you were surprised by when, like, the level at to is, like, would you... I don't want to get into exact how do you write all your songs, but was there a point where you look at his lyrics and you're working on music? Is there a sort of like a wow, Larry?
Yeah, it is kind of weird to see that such a big lug could be so you know
yeah
so personal and you know so so vulnerable.
Yeah. No, I think it's really an incredible element of Peg Boy that he really goes to those places that I think are.
Yeah, but yeah. You know, songs like Strong Reaction and Through My Fingers and Feel the Darkness, that's mostly Larry. He is an outstanding songwriter.
This is great, John. I'm going to let you go in about 10 minutes, if that's okay. I think I do want to hear, because you brought it up, and I didn't realize this until after you mentioned his name, that you worked with or are working with Jake Burns.
Yeah.
Who I think is quoted as one of the original influences on probably Naked Dragon and that sort of generation of like European or British punk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We were big fans of me personally. I loved Stiff Little Fingers.
Yeah.
We even put Suspect Device on a Naked Dragon record,
mm-hmm.
as you might recall. So we were big fans from way back, and then in 2004 he moved to Chicago, and I met him, and we wound up being great friends.
And you actually did I didn't know this, but you filled in on guitar on a tour in 2011 with Stiff Little Fingers.
Yeah, one of the highlights of my life. I got to play 9 shows with Stiff Little Fingers. I was filling for Ian McCallum. He got sick and they had these shows booked, and I played with Jake. We do this benefit every Christmas at Liars Club for Schwab Rehabilitation Center, and Jake was a part of that, as well as a lot of other local guys. So I was familiar, being a fan for 20, 30 years of Stiff Little Fingers, and actually playing Stiff Little Fingers songs with Jake at these benefits. He was like, hey, you know most of the songs already. Why don't you just play, these 10 shows, help us out while Ian gets better. And I was like, fuck yeah. And it was really one of the highlights of my whole life. Because Jake is a, you know when they say, and it's true, don't meet your heroes because you're almost always going to be disappointed.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that is true. But in the case of Jake, it is not. He turned out to be one of the greatest guys, just as great as I thought he was. He is.
Yeah, I people actually bring up that phrase a lot about not meeting your heroes. And I have to say it does. I say sometimes I do, but as a interviewer, I have to kind of meet my
heroes,
or else I'd be interviewing people I'm not interested in, which is not interesting to me. And in most cases, I am actually pleasantly surprised that I don't regret meeting them.
maybe I'm being a little unfair, but
I don't think so. I think that's kind of most of people's experiences are that, but I don't know. I think I just love talking to people already, so maybe I'm let in a little easier too, to some more difficult people to talk to. Or
yeah, Jake is a great, just a great guy, and he's another one who shares our thoughts about what it is to be a band. If you'll notice on Stiff Little Fingers, there's no individual credits given. Gone through all kinds of members, and Jake is the one who, he does a lot of the writing, if not most, if not all, and he doesn't bother taking credit, because he knows that it's everybody's band, makes all the people in the band contribute in their own way, so it's unfair to be sticking your name all over it. And he could easily do that, and never has.
I want to clarify, is Nefarious Fat Cats an actual band, or he does that to charity, to raise money? Is that what we're talking about?
That's what we're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, it's just a charity thing.
You also contributed to this Joy Thieves. Was that what it was called? Yeah.
Joy Thieves, yeah.
Yeah, I never heard about that. You were on a song. You and Joe were on, I'm looking at my notes here now. What was the song? Nihilist Landscape. It seemed like that was sort of like a, what I knew, like I saw Leatherface back in the day. That seemed like that those type of people like those group projects where everyone chips in here and there.
Yeah, that was interesting. Yeah, I think some of the stuff on that record's really good.
John, are you currently playing in the stuff now? I know, I mean, Pegboy is doing some shows soon, right?
Yeah, yesterday and the day before, we did a couple of shows at Liars Club to kind of shake the cobwebs off because we're going to England next week to do four shows.
That's great. Congratulations on that. That's amazing.
Yeah, it should be fun once we get over there. Yeah, it's the packing and getting ready and, you know, making sure everything's in order. That's the part that's not fun, but I think, you know, once we get over there, it's going to be a lot of fun.
Is most of the fun of being in the band now just getting together and playing those songs? Are there, I think I might ask Lear this, I can't remember. Is there new songs or do you plan to be in this? No.
No, absolutely not.
Now, just to get a little deep for a second, is that an okay thing? Do you guys enjoy that it's just, not just because you put out a lot of great music, but is that part of the joy for you is to play these songs you had already created?
Yeah. We just haven't been inspired or whatever to write new things. And I don't think, forcing things has never worked out good. So I don't try to force the issue, although it would be nice to have a new idea or two.
But there's no forcing of it. I do like that.
I don't think there's any point in forcing it. And if you're not inspired or you just don't have the will to create, I don't think you can create the will to create. So,
John, you just gave me the perfect ending. Thank you so much, John. It's been a pleasure to talk to you, and I'm glad we could make this happen.
Thanks for having me. I keep doing this. I enjoy the hell out of the podcast.
Oh, you actually have heard some of the episodes?
I actually have heard some.
Oh, good. Yeah, good. Well, thank you for listening.
Yeah, of course.
All right, John. So when I hang up, we actually hang up. So I'm not one of those that we'll talk after the hang up. No, when I hang up, we're done. So.
All right, buddy. Thanks again.
Yeah, you too.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
All right. Bye.
If you have made it this far, you just got done listening to Field of Darkness by Pegboy off their record Strong Reaction, recorded in 1991 and released on Quarter Stick Records. Thank you, everybody. That was quite a pleasure for me, and I hope you enjoyed that. Remember, go to the Patreon and you can learn more about helping out, and you can see the faces of the people talk to me during their interviews. Go to www.jugheadsbasementpodcast.com and become a member, or you can just do a one-time donation at PayPal. Just give that money to jugheadsbasement@gmail.com. Any way you can help is any way better than not way. Upcoming, I have as a returning guest Polly Van Damme. We will be talking about her escapades after leaving the Bomb Pops, her solo projects, her work with me and Ryan Rockwell, Billy Brown, and Tyson Cornell in the band Semi-Famous. Become a patron and be able to see the actual video of that. Thank you, everybody. Bye-bye.